Welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show, everybody. I think first, Tony, can you tell me a little bit about where we are on planet Earth? Just a little bit. Tony Rule, you're a longtime member of Royal Melbourne.
I am, and where we are on planet Earth is a long way from where you come from. So Melbourne is down in the south of Australia. Most international travellers gravitate to Sydney first, but coming to Melbourne is where you get the best golf. There's no question that Melbourne has the best golf courses in the country. And I might be a bit biased, but I think we've got some of the best golf courses in the world too.
But you say it in a way where, I mean, not only did I agree with you before you said it, but you say it in a way that it's not subjective. But that's almost true geographically. It's not even a creative thing. It's just the land is suited for the golf.
Absolutely. So if you think about some of the best golf courses in the world, most of them are on sand, and that's what we've got here. It's called the Sand Belt. And with Royal Melbourne, I guess and to a similar extent, Victoria, which is immediately across the road, is what distinguishes them from Kingston Heath and Metropolitan, is that there's a lot more movement in the ground at Royal Melbourne and Victoria because we're closer to the water. And there's a lot more depth to the sand here at Royal Melbourne. We were building dams because we've had some water issues over the last 10 years or so. And the sand goes down for like 30 feet. It's ridiculous. And that is why you can get such firm greens, which is what Richard Forsyth, our course superintendent, that's his key focus, get the greens firm. And it makes it a fantastic challenge when the greens are really firm. And hopefully we'll see that this week.
I'm having the experience that I have when I feel like we're about to do a good podcast where I want to ask you 90 questions. So I'm just going to go try to back up a little bit and explain to those people listening at home, wherever you are, that right now I'm going to just describe the room for a second. So we got it's actually funny enough, this is like a pea, split pea green plaid carpet, which we'll come back to the soup. I need to get back to the Royal Melbourne soup because I've never had it's unparalleled. Anyway, and we're in the clubhouse here, and the best golfers in the world are all in the backyard prepping for the tournament this weekend. That'll probably be over by the time this podcast is out.
I hope not.
But you,
when the podcast is out.
The podcast will be out in a couple days. But Tony, you're seated on the couch next to Richard Hatt. You are you're the head pro here for 26 years.
That's correct, yeah.
And so I guess I'm curious about, maybe you guys can go back and forth and talk a little bit about the community at Royal Melbourne, you know, because everyone's talking about it now because of the best players in the world playing here and this incredible course with all the history. But, you know, I mean, here we have, you know, you've devoted your life from your work standpoint of being here. And Tony, you've spent a lot of work here as well, but you're a member here. Can you talk a little bit about how that's different maybe for the listeners in America and how they kind of have a different view of it, especially, Richard, we started to talk about volume of memberships and price. And Tony, I don't know if you could feel like, from a sliver point of view, explaining how being a member at a private club is different here than it is in America.
Well, I guess that's my topic because I am chairman of membership.
But
what I would say is that Australian golf is modelled on the UK model. Relatively affordable golf. We've got a lot of golf courses in Australia. We're blessed with the number of golf courses in the country. So good golf is readily accessible. So it differs to the US model where you've got quite small memberships. Our playing membership is 1,800. Bear in mind, we've got two golf courses. So let's say the elite golf clubs in the US would have 300 members. This being an elite golf club in Australia, we have 900 members per course.
Is it actually busy though? Does it ever feel?
It can get busy if it's a nice day and it's a nice time of year for golf. March, April, you get some beautiful days for golf here. and it does get quite busy. But funnily enough, whether it's people's lifestyle or the age of our membership, I'm not sure. It's perhaps a little bit of both.
When you say age, do you mean what does it skew?
Well, our average membership age is about 56, I think, for men, and a little bit older for women.
Okay.
So Thursday, midweek golf, is big.
Really?
It is big. So the women, Wednesday is their big day.
Okay.
Thursday is the men's big day. When I first joined here, which is 35, 36 years ago or so, there was just no Thursday golf.
So how old were you when you joined?
I was a junior, so I joined when I was about 20.
That's incredible. See, that alone is really the most interesting thing. Is like 20-year-old, the only thing you're going to join is like, you know, the range ball discount package in the United States. It's not really possible. And so here they do a good job of cultivating youth golf.
Yeah, well, I'll put Richard and talk about what we do in terms of trying to promote young people into the game, because golf in Australia, in terms of participation, is flatlining a bit, if not declining, in the post-Norman era. So, but I'll get Richard to talk about the programs that we do for trying to get young people into the game.
Yeah, please do. I mean, you know, because this is not just people listening to the podcast, not just golfers, golf customers, golf users. It's also people that, administrators that work in golf, that have the ability to affect some type of change. I don't know if anybody listening has not seen the episode that we did of Adventures in Golf from Israel, where they talked all about, there's one golf course in Israel. That's it. And so they had to do these things that, you know, you would never think about doing, offering free lessons merely to get golf on people's radar. And they just sort of managed this thing, and now they have a busy club and they're looking at opening another. So we don't have to struggle with that because golf is popular already, but it's sad to hear you say that it's declining. Anyway, Richard, what do you have to say about all this?
Well, before we get on to the junior golf, when I first came here 26 years ago, even though it's got busier here, it was extremely quiet. And I remember we didn't have any timesheets, which now we have timesheets. When members go to play at this golf course, they put their name on a timesheet. But when I first came...
Sorry, when you first came here, what was your job at the time?
So I first came here as a teaching professional.
Oh, okay.
So I came here when I was 24. So I came as a teaching professional. And Bruce Green, who was the professional here, who's been my partner, who retired a year and a half ago, he offered me a job to come and teach here, which I thought would be fantastic, because you could never get onto Royal Melbourne to use their practice facilities and all their everything they had for the practice grounds. And so I had a meeting, and he said to me, I'd like you to be... I thought that'd be great. So I asked, when do I start? He said, tomorrow. So, which is in true Bruce form. So I turned up with my golf clubs.
Was that terrifying or exciting?
It wasn't terrifying. I turned up with my golf clubs and I practiced on the range and hitting golf balls. And then a member like Tony would come and have a practice, and Bruce would commandeer them to have a lesson.
Oh,
so the
funny.
First probably 200 or 300 lessons I gave, no one ever wanted a lesson. He just said, you know, you got to help the young fella out and give him a sort of, you know, and... And at that stage, I still had in vision of, you know, being a player like the rest. And I'm probably glad when I went out and even watched the Junior President's Cup yesterday and even just watched a few of the boys hit before, I think I made the right choice with going in the direction that I went. I'd probably be much more skinny than I am now. But that was a... So that started, and one lesson went to two, and two went to three, and then it just grew and grew as it went from there. And then... I became quite popular. Then I got offered a position at another golf club. And I told Bruce I was going to take this position. And he said to me, I've been thinking a long time that maybe we should join together. And that's how we joined. So after 3 years here, I then became a joint head professional with him for the last 21 years. And then he just retired a year and a half ago. So I've continued on solely as a head pro.
Right.
But getting back to what we're talking about, those before we get onto that, with the... we used to have a ball race on the first tee. I don't know if you've ever heard of
ball
that.
Race.
A ball race.
Never heard of it.
So it was like a tube that was on a slight tilted angle on a stand, and it had a hole at one end and another hole at the other. And when you came onto the green, you would drop your ball that you were going to play into this tube, and it would roll to the bottom. And all they'd do is you'd lift it out. Whoever's next ball was there was the person who would hit off the tee. You remember that, Tony, wouldn't you?
This is how finding a partner.
So when I was first joined, it was a very traditional club. You needed to have a coat and tie to go into the club. You couldn't into the clubhouse. You You traditionally on a Sunday you would go into the dining room and you might have roast beef or something, a bit of Yorkshire pudding or something like that.
Kind of a Mirfield situation.
I've not enjoyed their
enjoyed. Sorry.
Well, I have been to Mirfield, but I didn't get to enjoy their lunch, which I hear is pretty good. But anyway, and you might have a glass or two of red or something like that, and then you'd get out to the tee and you'd put your ball in the race. And this was a Sunday afternoon, and there may only be five or six groups going out. So that has, wow, in that context, it has changed quite a lot. Now membership now is quite a deal larger than it was when I first joined. But apart from being on membership, I'm also the chair of the History and Archives Committee, and I've been looking at past records where at one point there was only 500 members of the club.
Wow.
This would have been maybe in the 1950s, early 1950s.
Early in its history.
Well, relatively early in its history. The club was formed in 1891, from memory.
Okay.
And we moved, originally the club was in what is now pretty much inner city Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to a suburb called Sandringham in 1905, and then Mackenzie visited in 1926, which was a significant part of the club's development.
Was that important for the club's ultimate success, do you believe?
Absolutely, yeah. So, unfortunately, people who are listening really need to come and have a look at some of our old photos and the things that we've got in archives. But golf holes were very penal at that period in the early 1900s. And it was Mackenzie that really introduced this strategic nature of golf courses. So there's a hole for those people who are listening that want to come here and appreciate the difference between a penal golf hole and strategic. Then it is no better illustrated than on the 15th of the West Course, where you've got mounds that were there in 1905 that go all the heavily grassed mounds that go all the way across the fairway, and bunkers that would go all the way across the fairway, and you can still see the indentations in the turf where those bunkers used to be. So the 15th of the West dates to 1905, but when Mackenzie came in, he re-bunkered it, but he left the mounds there. But if you look at his 1926 plan of 15 West, the mounds have been removed on his drawings. So there's some conjecture as to why he left it. But getting back to your question, was Mackenzie's visit significant? Extremely significant, because the way he changed the nature of the golf course. And also, when he came here, the club sold some excess land and bought new land. So the West Course, which is attributed to Mackenzie, some of the holes were there. There's probably three or four that remain in the general area where they were, and the rest of it's all new.
So I'd like to not get into too many specifics, because I can imagine most of the people listening are having a tough time with a frame of reference visualizing the course, especially the way you can. I've played it once, and you know, aside from just a really magically, revealing round of golf, where it seems like every time you turn a corner, it was just like, wow, wow, wow. What do you think? You know, you talked a little bit about the ball race. Is that right? Is that what you call it? The ball race. As far as you talked about holes moving from being penal to, what would you say the word is?
Strategic.
How would you say, in general, that is experienced on a golf hole as a player? I mean, Royal Melbourne is obviously the example here.
The way Mackenzie designed a course is that, and you can see this on the drawings that he did for Royal Melbourne, is that he would highlight two ways to play the golf course, and he would draw lines. So for the weaker player, there's a line going and avoiding the trouble and going to the where there's fairway. And then for the stronger player, he would have these things that he called heroic carries, where you would attempt to fly the bunkers to get you in the best position to put your next shot on the green. So that is truly strategic. The hole is playable by all golfers in terms of their ability.
So does this relate on some level to the line of charm? Are you familiar with that?
I'm not really familiar with the line of charm.
So basically, McKenzie would say, there's two ways to do this. There's the easy way, but that's going to wind you up with some more complications later. Or you can do it the hard way, which will be... Is that kind of what it is? You sort of are faced with an easy decision in the beginning or a hard decision in the beginning? Is that kind of a good example?
Well, let's put it this way. There's an easy... He gives you an easy way out.
Uh-huh.
He gives you an easy way out. So that's the beauty of the golf course, in that as much as weaker players enjoy it just as much as the elite players.
I'm curious to know about, and I, you know, feel free to tag team here. I'm not sure how common this is in the United States to have a course, a member course with 36 holes. But the tournament is sort of an amalgamation of those 36. It's sort of 18 hand-selected holes that more or less aren't played very often by the membership. Is that true, first of all?
Yeah, that is totally correct. We play it on special occasions. How many times a year, Tony? Four?
Isn't that very popular? Is everyone super excited for that?
It is always booked out. Booked out. Goes all day.
I'm going to sign up, and I'm not even welcome.
People hit all day. And that's, you know, sometimes I think to myself, why wouldn't we play it more often? But I can see why, you know, when we do open it up, it is special. So we have 12 of the West and 6 of the East make up the composite course, which means when we're playing on the West course, we cross the road once, play over there, and we play 4 holes, and we come back over. And then on the East course, we play 4 holes, cross a road, play 2 holes, cross a road, and then we play out and come back in. So now we play on the inner boundaries. We don't cross any roads, so I guess that helps for security, for tournaments, keeping everything connected all together, less footprint of people moving all around. So, but it is special. And then I don't know whether you'd say chance, Tony, or not, but they are the best holes by far.
Interesting.
It's on the best ground, but... Also, what I would say is that going from one course to the other is seamless. If you came as a visitor and they put you on the composite course, you wouldn't pick which holes were which, east or west. And there's two reasons for that. The first one is that when McKenzie came to Australia, he met a member whose name was Alec Russell. And they shared, and Russell's a very good player in his own right. He won an Australian Open, funnily enough, here at Royal Melbourne in 1924. But they had similar thoughts on golf course architecture. And they actually formed a design company for Australia. So Russell and McKenzie were golf course architects here in Australia as a business.
And this is not Alistair McKenzie?
Yeah.
Oh, this is?
Alistair McKenzie and Alec Russell formed a design company. And it was Russell who designed the East Course. But the same person constructed both courses. And his name was Mick Morecambe. And he was the greenkeeper here for 40 years or something. And they dug all the bunkers with a horse and a scoop. So it took... And there's a lot of bunkers on Royal Melbourne, and they're big. And it took them 5 years to build the West Course.
That's significantly longer than I would have guessed.
When McKenzie came in 1926, the course didn't open until 1931.
I guess I'm curious to hear a little bit more, and Tony, I'm sure you know a tremendous amount about this. The relationship between McKenzie and Russell, I guess... Really, where I kind of came into this story was at this course in Wellington called Paraparaumu, which I was pretty excited to find.
That is just the best fun you'll ever have on a golf course. It is brilliant. And it's got the one of the best par threes you'll ever play, the 16th. Goes from the top of one dune to the top of another. And you miss it right, the ball just gets carried about 50 feet away. It is a brilliant golf hole.
The entire place, I mean, I just, and you know, part of it had the element of surprise for us, and so that was exciting. But learning a bit about that story and comparing it with Titirangi later on the wonderful trip we had in New Zealand, and then kind of going back to my experience of playing here, I just kind of began to be curious about the relationship between C.B. McDonald and Seth Rayner. And I don't know if that's, they didn't make it down here, obviously, so it's not as popular as these Mackenzie courses. But I'm kind of just interested in the idea that, you know, we talked about it a little bit. Mackenzie came down here for 6 weeks just before he was working on Augusta and Cyprus.
Yes, it was. He came in 1926, and Augusta was a bit after that, as was Cyprus. Augusta and Cyprus were the early 30s for memory.
And he just came down here and basically came up with a lot of great ideas that were fulfilled by men like Alec Russell and the superintendent, Mick Morcom. Mick Morcom. Mm. And was there, we played Metropolitan this morning, was there another Mackenzie involved in that course?
I'm not completely across Mackenzie's influence at Metropolitan. That Metropolitan has had, unfortunately, in the 60s, some of their holes were taken from them by the state government to build a school. So they got an architect from the US called Dick Wilson, who effectively built an entire new back nine for them. And then Mike Clayton and his team have done work there, but at the moment, the work's being done by Paul Mogford and Neil Crafter, who've been doing work at Bowen Heads, which you haven't been to, you must.
Yeah, it's on my list, and for some reason, can you tell me what it means, Barwon Heads? Like, what is it? What's the point of going? Because it's not on the sand belt.
No, but it's on the coast. It's got fantastic views, but also the first six holes, there's like craters and off the fairway and fantastic movement in the ground. It's not long, but it's very windy because the course is very exposed. We talked about the 16th at Paraparam. The 13th at Bowen Heads is about 130 metres. And once again, you elevated tee to this green. If you miss a green, you're doing very well to get up and down. It's just a different golf course. It's got a different feel about it. It's not vanilla, which is what you want to look for in golf courses.
Yeah, I definitely like everything but vanilla.
You would love Hirono, where I've just come back from.
Oh, Tokyo.
And it's in Kobe,
yeah.
3 hours south of Kobe. And Martin Ebert has just restored it pretty much. It's phenomenal. Anyway, Rich?
Just on that 13th hole at Bowen Heads, am I right in saying that one of our members, all of our members are members of Bowen Heads, but one of our members, Richard Allen, was playing with his brother-in-law, and he holes out on that hole, and his brother-in-law holes out as well.
No way.
It's in the Guinness Book of Records.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
They both holed out playing in the same group, brother-in-laws, on that same hole on the 13th.
They're related in many ways now.
Correct.
We're going to take a quick break, everybody. We'll be right back. We're going to dig into a little bit more of the President's Cup and maybe some more general golf in Australia information.
Folks, you've heard me talk about it. And I'm not talking about, never mind. I'm talking about Precision Pro. You've heard me talk about them. I got a chance to meet these guys. I went out to Cincinnati. I spent 4 years with them in 1 week. It was incredible. Anyway, what's the main thing that golfers have in their bag that they're going to use most during a round? I think you know what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a putter. I'm not talking about your favorite iron. I'm not talking about your right arm to flag the beverage cart. I'm talking about your rangefinder. All golfers need a rangefinder that they can trust to know the precise distance in their target for nearly every shot. whether you're on the tee box or in the fairway. That's true. I've thought about using it for putting, just so I can be super accurate, because putting is obviously lagging a little bit. Getting a phone call, folks. Anyway, I carry the NX9 HD rangefinder by Precision Pro Golf. It's easy to use, incredibly fast, and most importantly, it gives me the exact yardage to my target so I can choose the right club and swing with confidence. I actually love pulling it out. People are like, what is that? I'm like, it's Precision Pro. Get down with the green and blue, my guy. Green and gray, I mean. Not to mention, Precision Pro offers free battery replacement services for the life of your rangefinder. We all know how annoying it is to run out of batteries, but you get an extra one when you get it, and then you get rangefinder batteries throughout the, like I said, life of your rangefinder. So you're not only getting a rangefinder, you're signing up for a lifetime service. So really, it just depends on how long you live. And at that point, that's where the podcast sort of, that's where it just drops off, and it's up to you at that point. Live healthy, obviously. Don't play golf in lightning. Don't shoot adventures in golf, because that we've talked about that with my insurance company, and it does decrease my lifespan. But, you know, it increases the benefits, and we all have fun. We've all signed up. Me and the crew have all signed. It's like an NDA for your life. Good news, the NX9 HD rangefinder is on sale for $40 off. Even better, listeners of the podcast can receive an extra $10 off by using the coupon code ERIK, E-R-I-K, at checkout. Go to precisionprogolf.com and use the coupon code ERIK at checkout for $50 off the NX9 HD rangefinder today. Swing with confidence, hit more greens with Precision Pro Golf.
All right, got a very, very special read from you. One read that fits into three stripes, because you know how much I love the three stripes, and I'm very excited to share something with you. Who knows what that'll be? Some secrets, maybe? Some secrets in the dirt? No. Adidas took their knit game to a whole new level, and honestly, I wore these just the other day, and I was pretty comfortable and pretty tethered to the ground. Anyway, have you seen the new Tor 360 XT Prime Knit that was just released? It's the first waterproof knit that they've ever had. So what you get there is a lot of flexibility around your little old feet, or big old feet, depending on what size your foot is, obviously. Although your foot may be big in stature, but not so much in, you know, you can have a big foot but still have a small size. You know what I mean? Anyway, they come with a 1-year waterproof warranty and 3 fresh new colorways so you can stand out on the course. It's important to stand out. Sometimes if you're golf game, no, anyway. It's built on the XT traction sole, so you get amazing grip, but it's still lightweight and comfortable. That is true. Anyway, head over to adidas.com/US/golf to snag a pair. And follow Adidas Golf on Instagram and Twitter to stay updated on all of their newest releases. Until then, see you out there looking fresh. All right, we're back. But we did take a minute and just go full golf geek about McKenzie and greens and par threes. Now, I mean, Richard, is there another part of the world that's quite as concentrated with incredibly high quality golf, incredibly historic golf, and yet some might say it's kind of similar because it's all part of this sand belt geographic area, but each course is its own personality, its own membership, its own history. Is there another place in the world like it?
I wouldn't think. I mean, the closest I can think of maybe is around that Monterey Peninsula. You know, they have courses around that area and those things. But it is very unique here. I mean, it's a hidden gem. I mean, most Americans, you know, if they get past the flight of 14 hours to get here, once they get here, it's fantastic. I mean, we speak the same language. You can drink the water, you know. I mean,
I thought you were going to say you can drink at 18.
Well, you can too, so they're probably happy with that. But you can eat, the food's great. And just to come down here, and once you get here, it's so close. You know, They're all in a vicinity, really, really tight. Within, you know, a space of 15 kilometers, you're going from one course to the next. You know, I went into the States in 2000 and we played right across, but we had to go from one side to the other to be able to play all those great courses
that
we went across.
Pretty disparate.
Yeah.
How do you describe Melbourne as a city?
As they always say, extremely livable. I mean, it's ever-changing. Like yesterday we had 39 degrees.
That's 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
And then this morning we had cold wind and rain. I mean, it just changed overnight.
It was about 58 this morning.
And
I don't know what happened.
Talking to a few of the young Prisons Cup boys and some of their parents, and they just couldn't believe it. You know, they just couldn't believe that It would change that quickly.
I was looking at the weather map, the weather calendar, and it was like 60, 60, 58, 65, 100 58. And I was like, what's happening on Monday? Why is it 100 degrees all of a sudden?
Yeah, it doesn't change. And that's, we often say all four seasons in one day. We often say that for Melbourne. You know, you come wearing your t-shirt in the morning, followed by your jacket on, waterproofs on. By the end of the day, you're back into your bathers.
I enjoyed it. What do you have to say, Tony?
There's a very simple reason for such significant temperature changes, and it depends on where the wind blows, but you get 100 degrees because it comes from the north straight off the desert, and when it swings around to the south, it comes straight off the ocean. So that explains the dramatic changes in temperature.
Literally 45 degrees in temperature shift. Tony, did you grow up around here?
Sorry?
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in what's called Western Victoria.
Okay.
It's a little place called Warrnambool, and I used to play my golf at a little club called Port Fairy, which Mike Clayton's been doing some work on now for 10 or 15 years. It's not a wealthy club by any means. Costs about $600 to be a member. Little small town with about 2,500 people. But it is an absolute classic links course. A number of the holes are right in the dunes with great views and similar to Bowen Heads. Very exposed and very windy. The ball, it gets so windy, the ball oscillates on the tee. That's when you know it's windy.
Not even on the green with the tee. How would you describe, you know, it sounds like you've played golf in a few different places and countries and continents. How, when you come home, when you come back to Australia, specifically Melbourne, how do you describe that feeling of playing golf here?
That's a tough question. Look, I love traveling and playing other golf in other countries. I think you can learn things from wherever you go. We were talking about what areas would be similar to this. Well, the Berkshire, and you've got the Berkshire, you've got Sunningdale, you've got Wentworth, although not too sure about some of the recent course changes at Wentworth, but you've got some classic golf courses. There's a golf course called New Zealand. What's the cult? There's a cult course, Swinley Forest, which is, unfortunately, I've never had the opportunity to play, but people who play Swinley Forest rave about it as being a great experience. And I really do think that's great. And then last year I was very fortunate. I went to Southport and we played Birkdale, Lytham and Hoylake 3 days straight. So I think they're all different, but the one thing that you will get here that you won't get anywhere else, the quality of the bunkering. It's it's almost like it's artistic, the way the bunkers have been designed.
You mean as far as depth and space and the quality of the sand and the size?
And the shape.
The shape. Mm. I mean, the bunkers here are both stunning and terrifying. I mean, they are terrifying, especially when you're in them. But they're all very fair and consistent, which is also very unusual. Mm. That level of consistency with a hard wall, a soft bottom, reasonably, it's reasonable to expect that after one or two of them, you should be able to get out of them pretty easily.
Mm. I just think that the shape of them, it's something quite unique to Melbourne, to the Sandbelt.
Yeah, I agree. You know, when you play around the world, it's almost like you can't make bunkers like that anymore. I'm not sure how. I mean, you see all these brand new courses with all this technology, but some of these bunkers here are just so beautiful. And do we have a lot of aerial shots from those drones now? They are magnificent. And there's a great hole, Fourth of the West, which is the second of the composite course of the Prisons Cup. But they have a drive bunkers there, which are beautiful. And to stand up on top of that hill and look back and see that, you can't make them. I don't know why they can't make them. But I remember Ben Crenshaw came here and played. It might have been a World Cup. And I remember after he finished that tournament, he went out on the composite course. He walked the whole course and walked every bunker and looked at those bunkers and watched them and took photos. Because he just, you know, how do you get them to look like that? I mean, maybe it was the way they dug them out by hand, Tony. Was that a fair comment?
I think the fact that they, the rounded scoop that the horse used to cart to build them is one of the key reasons why you get the bunkers looking like they do.
Right.
Yeah. Rather than the square blade of a bulldozer.
Yeah, you have a little bit, a different tool offers a different outcome.
The other thing is the difference here is that the greens have got a lot of movement in them, but they're beautiful to putt on. And you can get our green staff here spend an awful lot of time trying to get rid of power, which is a problem for a lot of golf courses around the world, but they've done a brilliant job in doing so.
You don't like it down here?
No.
Why not? I would think it'd be great down here.
Well, what happens is that it grows. Well, you know the issues with power, and it grows quickly, and
flowers.
you get uneven roll, and so that's why we don't like it. And we've got what's called Sutton's mix. It's a mix of bent grasses in it, and if you get power in the greens, it'll grow quicker than the bent, and then you'll get a really rough, a rough roll, and so we don't like it in the greens.
More power to you. I mean, they love it over at Pebble.
Yeah, well, all of California, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, Cyprus.
We don't have a choice.
Cyprus is power for memory.
Yeah. I'm not sure I can adequately. First of all, before the podcast is over, where is the birds? Is that what these are?
You
birds?
Know, I was thinking about that you could hear that noise in the background.
Absolutely, can
hear
that's
it. Actually the flue on top of the open fireplace that sits up on top. That's twisting around. That's following.
Oh, that's
the wind.
Not birds.
It's not. But I thought you would ask that at some point. But it's we're sitting right next to the fireplace here, and above is a flue that moves around and catches the air. And because it's windy outside today, it's moving around squeaking.
Yeah. We
probably need to put some oil on that.
Because we get some
no
oil.
Birds. But we do have plenty of birds here. We have some crows that, which just, you know, digressing, we have some crows here that are very aggressive. And out on the putting green, they'll come and open your bag and take your lunch out of your bag.
Dang, I've had that happen.
Yeah, in the pro shop, we've been getting them, training them up to get watches and wallets and
all sorts
smart. Of things. So, yeah,
that's smart.
They're quite good.
Focus on the, pre-1960 timepieces. That'd be great. At Meltro, they had a great selection of birds with mohawks and great haircuts.
Yeah, we have a lot of great bird life down here, and especially, well, there's bird life here as well a lot, but at Metro they have lovely high trees, you know, those big gums and things like that, so they obviously attract a lot of that birds, where we have a lot more lower foliage here and things like that, but there's plenty of birds we have.
I did actually see a photo that someone showed me this morning. There's an animal here called a blue-tongued lizard. Have you heard of a blue-tongued lizard?
I haven't.
They're about a foot long. They're quite a big lizard with a blue tongue, not surprisingly. And anyway, there was one in the men's locker room, which I've never got no idea how it got there. I've never seen a blue-tongued lizard on the course, let alone in the men's locker room.
I feel like you're about to deliver a great joke. So we've covered the bird, experience. But the next thing is, I'm not sure I can adequately describe to anyone at home who hasn't been here, when you talk about the greens being hard, it's very real. They are hard. I can't think of many things that are as hard that are not like a table. I don't know. It's insane.
Yeah. I mean, I might lead off and Tony will do a lot more on that. But just for us, you know, when people come and play here, they wonder, they're hard. But that's how we play them all the time.
All the time.
I can't remember the last time we repaired a pitch mark.
Not yet. No, you can't make a pitch mark.
No.
You couldn't make a pitch mark maybe if you threw a club. I mean, it is very hard.
Yeah. And bouncy. And I think that's, as Tony said before, with the sand here and the way we prepare the course, Richard Forsyth, you have to play that course to play for that hardness. You know, I was watching early on in the juniors, you know, some of them were playing shots in there that they just thought they could get it to stop, but you have to play at the front, use the bounce and use the contours. And, you know, this golf course can come up and bite you at any time. Sometimes, you know, it looks wide and generous off the fairways, but if you're in the wrong spot and you've got a certain bouncy green, you won't stop it. It'll just roll over.
I was very saddened when on my second shot on the third hole at Metro this morning, I hit a wonderful 7-iron downwind. I thought I gave it more than enough room, and it landed like a yard short of the hole, and then just jumped almost off the property. And that's a normal thing here. You just literally start playing front. Do you basically look for a number front edge of the green, Tony?
Oh, I'm not that good a golfer. Richard might. I'm just happy to try and hit one out of the middle. But picture this. There's on the fifth of the West, so it's the third of the course this week. It's 160 metres or something. And you hit your tee shot there and you can hear the ball land on the green. Now, how many other golf courses in the world does that happen? It's never happened to me anywhere else.
Yeah.
And for the agronomists out there, if there's any course superintendents listening, we had a tournament here earlier in the year and the greens were really firm. And I said to the guys, what's your moisture content? And he said 10%. So they run them pretty lean.
Yeah, that's technically speaking, that's dehydrated for a human body. So I don't know, I don't know what that is for a green. I'm supposed to be 90% water, I thought. any questions for me? We're about done.
No, I haven't got any questions for you. Tony, got any?
Yeah, I've got one. How'd you get involved in doing all this?
I mean, that's a great question. It started off as a fascination with tour guides when I was a kid. We would go on trips with my parents, and I would just ask the tour guide 1,000 questions. Then I learned how to do that with a video camera, and then I got interested in golf. And I mean, I hope I'm taking your question seriously, but that is basically what happened. Is I became a filmmaker, then I got interested in golf, and then I fell in love with golf, and now it's that the ridiculous joke of my life is that that really is my job, is to just go around and play golf and ask questions, and you know, not offend anybody in the so doing. So I really appreciate your guys' time, and I guess I could do a little bit more about. You know, you've had these pro golfers here before in your tenure as a member and as a club steward, right, Tony? But it must feel pretty incredible to have them calling this their home for the week.
Yeah, well, one of our members actually wrote a really good article about this yesterday. But to watch these guys play the golf course, there's a shot Mickelson hit from 8 years or not 2011, so 8 years ago. I can still picture the shot. It was just this driver purposely cut round the corner it was on 11 West. It was just like, it just blew my mind to watch how he could work the ball around the course and the way they play the course. And I was watching Ben Ahn playing bunker shots on the short fifth hole this morning and playing shots. I'm just going, that's just a ridiculous amount of skill to be able to do that. I think that that's what I love, just watching and seeing how good these guys are.
Because you have something to compare it to. You know that these greens are very hard. You know that they're going to run away. So in order to see someone to take a bunker shot that's maybe downhill, down grain, you say that's impossible to stop and that they somehow keep it within 5 feet. Whereas on TV, you're like, good shot. You can't see the difficulty.
Correct. There's a lot of slope on our greens that people, that the TV doesn't highlight. So the fourth green has a lot of slope, so much so that only about 10% of it's pinnable. That's a big green.
Wow.
So
that must make the super's job. Do you think that makes it easier or hard?
He's got ways and means around it, which I won't go into.
Well, what's that, Richard?
He doesn't have any trouble putting any pin position because there's only about two on it. So
right,
he knows
right.
Where to put it each time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go. I would like to end on, you know, I played out here and it was cold. And that's common, I'm learning, in Melbourne. But we were met on the sixth hole by a small golf cart that had a large plastic box on the back with a faucet attached to it. And the gentleman drove up and said, "Would you like some soup?" And I said, "Yeah, I mean, it's really cold. I would love some soup." And he proceeded to, you know, it was like a coffee pot. And I'm describing this because you guys know what it is, but if you're listening to this, which you would be, otherwise you wouldn't be hearing what I'm saying, it's literally like a to-go coffee container, but the faucet was like modified to manage the split pea soup that was about to come out of it. And I mean, I'm pretty sure I've never had a better experience with soup in general, much less soup on a golf course, much less soup on a golf course being delivered to me on a golf cart. When did the soup, when did the split pea soup recipe get created, and how long has it been being delivered on a cart on cold days?
We've probably done soup now for the last 5 years or so.
Is that, it's a relatively new.
Relative new, and that was basically like a big urn, and as you said, they've retrofitted the tap, make it wider, because obviously thicker soup can't get through the small.
Somebody went to like a plumbing store 100%. And created this.
Yep, they had it all made up, purpose-built, custom-built.
That's what I love. You get that at a club, because who said, let's bring soup on the course? And then someone said, how do I bring soup on the course? I need to solve this problem. This is what I love about each club that I visit around the world. You know, like you're talking about Mirfield, each club has its own little way of solving a problem. And I need to do a better job of keeping track of this stuff, because it's really fascinating. What are you going to say?
Well, there's some clubs that have the halfway huts, not a lot. But the best halfway hut I've ever seen is the one at the end of the 10th of Sunningdale Old. And it, for those people who've played it, it's an elevated tee, long par four, pine trees either side, and then you can just see at the end the halfway hut, and you're going, yes.
It's a horizon. Yeah. A
bacon sandwich is what you have there when you get to there.
Okay. I haven't played it yet, so I'm looking forward to that sight.
It's beautiful. I know the hole exactly. There's a big gorse bush on the left-hand side just before there.
Well, I look forward to enjoying the soup once again, and perhaps the composite layout one day. But I enjoy the stories of Royal Melbourne and how the world has, you know, embraced the history here and the future and everything. And I guess that's it, unless you guys have anything else, any other favorite golf quote maybe?
Well, outside, obviously,
Royal I'm just Melbourne's, not willing to end.
Royal Melbourne's obviously my favorite, but we were talking before, you know, my second favorite really around here is Metropolitan.
No, I said favorite golf quote.
Oh, favorite
like,
golf quote.
Like the 5 inches between your ears. Tony's got one. Yeah. Take us out on a good one here.
I've got this. I was telling a journalist this one this morning. Of course, the Patrick Reed incident has been playing on people's minds a bit. And the thing about it to me is that he blamed the fact that the camera angle made it look worse than it was. But I'd always remember the story about Bobby Jones in the US Open, and he called a penalty on himself. He was removing a twig or something. The ball just moved slightly. No one else saw it. And Jones called a penalty on himself. And a spectator at the end of play said to Bobby, congratulations on, you know, doing the right thing. And Jones responded, well, you might as well congratulate me for not robbing a bank. Unfortunately, you know, that way of viewing the rules and the etiquette of the game is disappearing a little bit, I'm a bit of an old school type, and I think that is disappointing that those things are happening in the game at the moment.
Well, I agree completely, and hopefully we can all take part in that. I guess I'm getting one last note coming in here. What should we talk about how 7 West is not the original McKenzie hole, and that it used to be played from a different direction, and it was commonly referred to as Mount Misery? Remnants of this hole exist today. Tony, do you think this is relevant? As at the wee hours of the podcast.
If you're a real history buff yes, it is relevant in as much as neither McKenzie or Russell designed it, which is interesting in itself because Russell was still alive at the time and still actively involved in the club. But it was designed by a chap by the name of Ivo Witten, who was a famous Australian golfer who won 5 Australian Opens. And he designed it in about 1937, for memory. As to who built it, I'm not sure, because that was getting towards the end of Morecambe's tenure, and he trained up a fellow by the name of Claude Crockford, who was so Morecambe worked here for 35 years, and then Crockford for 40. So for 75 years, Royal Melbourne only had two greenkeepers, or as they're called now, course superintendents. So it's an and even today, Richard's been here for, Richard Forsyth's been here for 10 years, and I think he's only about the seventh since the club was first formed in 1891. So that consistency is what makes Royal Melbourne really special, because we haven't had high turnover, and they've protected what was left in 1926. And we spent a lot of time looking at aerial photos on, just to make sure that we're not missing anything, that, right. that over time things haven't changed, or a bunker's disappeared, or whatever, or changed shape. So we spent a lot of time looking at that.
I mean, that's something that more and more courses are doing. I think it's really important, especially as you look at, you know, where was the original architect? I mean, who are you crediting on the scorecard, right? We should have it back. Is there this soup? Is it on the property right now, or is it only for non-President's Cup days?
Soup.
Do we know?
Well, you basically, you want some soup. Is that it? we might not have the pea soup on today. We might have the pumpkin soup today.
There's also pumpkin?
We've got a number of varieties of soup.
Look,
if
you ever want
to
talk
to me. There's a good tomato soup.
Is it really?
Yeah.
It's perfect day for soup.
Well, on that note, can I offer you a soup?
Well, you know, the squeaky wheel gets oiled, and the squeaky flue, I guess it's also going to get oiled, too. Thank you guys so much for your time, and really looking forward to spending more with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.